denied a safe passage to the UK. I couldn't say no when she invited me to see for myself what it was like, nor did I want to. I've always felt strongly about the benefits of living in an inclusive society. And, as a Londoner, I experience them every single day. I've had the privilege of growing up around people from all over the world. Of course we should be welcoming child refugees into our country, as if we could do anything else. You don't turn children away. It's unthinkable. But to talk about it more, I wanted to be more informed. I wanted to see the jungle for myself. It was a huge shanty town. People were friendly to us, but you could see how easily things might become dangerous. You could see many young people having to survive alone. I worried for the girls especially. That's when I apologised, in tears, to the young Afghani boy. I wish I hadn't. It wasn't appropriate, and I wish I'd done a better job of keeping myself together. That's when I apologised to him, on behalf of my country too. It was a clumsy thing to say. I wanted to say I'm sorry, and I wanted to acknowledge that I was part of the problem and that we are all part of the problem if we don't do more to help. The words came out badly, and for that I felt foolish. I was embarrassed about putting it like that. I can be a moron, but my intentions were straightforward and without any agenda. I just wanted to help in whatever tiny way I could. I got a lot of stick about my visit to Calais. I've always been trolled and bullied on social media, but after Calais, the online bullying I experienced went off the charts. People jumped to conclusions and made assumptions about everything I had said. When I said, for example, that I believed our invasion of Iraq was wrong, they accused me of slandering the armed forces as a whole. People wrote in violent terms about what they'd like to do to me and what I deserved. They often included my kids when they discussed dishing out my punishments. I minded all that. I still mind, and the bullying still goes on, and sometimes I fight back. I know, people say, oh, just ignore the tweets and the comments and the abuse and block the bullies and it'll all go away. And occasionally I do, but I also think, no. Ignoring the bullies and letting them give voice to bigotry and threaten violence without rebuke or redress is a kind of silence that I'm not interested in. I don't react well to being bullied or backed into a corner. I don't want to be silent. That's why I keep tweeting, even though my Twitter feed is hijacked by people tweeting hateful comments. Often this takes the form of men consistently tweeting the same three charges against me to prove their point and win their argument. The charges are, number one, I'm a bad mother. Number two, I'm famous because of my dad. And number three, I'm stupid. In other words, what they do is belittle me. Because if you shout at someone enough and tell her she's a dumb woman who wouldn't be anywhere without her dad, then she'll shut up, right? Example. I was tweeting about a Theresa May speech recently and someone tweeted, Oi, Lily, can I smell your privates? I replied, yeah, sure, but you might want to wait because I'm on the blob. My Twitter feed went mad. People were outraged. How can you say that? The tweets went. No wonder everyone hates you, they went on, when you talk like that. I was like, what planet are we on? This guy just asked to sniff my privates, but I mentioned my period and I'm the one who's disgusting. I don't think that the men who run the tabloids and who berate me on Twitter like women much. Not just women, either. I think they're scared of anyone who isn't like them, who isn't white and middle class and male. Because those men who run things, they aren't necessarily cleverer or better than everyone else, but for some reason they've managed to make all the rules for hundreds and hundreds of years. No wonder they're resentful and defensive when the rest of us are angry and have decided that we want a bit of what they've got. So it's like, no, you can't have a piece. You're disgusting. You've got a vagina. No, you're not having any of it either because you're black and you're a criminal and you're Asian and you've probably got a bomb under there, so you're not allowed any of it either. You're all threatening to me, and so I'm going to vilify and bully you as much as I can to silence and shame you. I don't want to be silent. Women have been silenced for millennia, and I'm not going to be part of that. I want to speak up, and if that means I sometimes get it wrong, then I should be able to correct myself, apologise, move on, and still carry on speaking up. As a woman, I'm not meant to be an angel or a saint or a martyr or to have faultless encyclopedic answers all the time. I'm a woman only, and like all women, I don't ask for special treatment. Like all women, I just ask not to be repressed or silenced. I've never been saintly. I know I'm a narcissist. I can behave badly. I'm capable of self-sabotage and self-destruction. I have a history of mental illness, drug abuse, and addictive behaviour. I can be petulant and spoilt, short-tempered and stubborn. But even when I'm deep in foggy, cloudy behaviour, numbing myself with whatever I can, some part of me remains self-aware. I'm hyper, hyper self-aware. It's what has kept me from going under. I've sometimes felt like I've been drowning and lost, and as if I've disappeared. But I've always stopped myself, even if it's in a destructive way with drugs or hospitalisation, from losing it completely. I think it's one of the reasons why I both perform and why, counterintuitively, I rarely lose myself in a performance. It's why I'll never be a world-class singer. I'm not talking about my voice range or my tonal abilities. Those aren't the things that are holding me back. I don't want to be a world-class singer. That was never my intention or desire. I'm not like Adele, say, or Amy Winehouse, who both knew from an early age that using their vocals was their destiny. But still, when people identify me, mostly they say, Lily Allen, pop star. I was indeed a pop star. That's what I became, serving my apprenticeship in public for everyone to see. The problem is, like most people in their early 20s, I was also trying to figure out who the hell I was as a person, and doing that while inhabiting pop stardom land is especially tricky and confusing. On the one hand, you're treated like a child, spoiled and indulged at every juncture. You check into a hotel and your room has been upgraded. There's a bottle of Cristal up there, in an ice bucket, waiting for you. Of course we'll send a car for you. We'd love to send you a hamper of beauty products. Please wear this dress. Cue reactions of, wow, this is so great, I love all this, lucky me. Which then leads to, as the spoiling becomes normalised, why is the car late? Why is there this shitty champagne and not ice-cold Cristal? Which morphs into, when you're overtired, far away from home, lonely as fuck and feeling like you're dying inside, what the fuck? I fucking hate Cristal. Get it the fuck out of here. Just fuck, fuck, fuck. But then, right at the very same time as all this mollycoddling, you've got to deal with all this other super grown-up stuff that no one prepares you for. Signing scary contracts. Taking on accountants. Running up huge bills that you are hardly aware of. Hiring people. Firing them. I know that entering any career has its learning curves, its challenges and difficulties as well as its rewards, but the thing about pop stardom is that these things, the challenges and the rewards, are amplified to a huge degree, and if you achieve success quickly, as I did, you don't get to practice any of it. It turns out there is no real apprenticeship program for fame, which means you are ill-prepared to handle it, and as a result, you stumble. You stumble publicly. The tabloids love it when you do that. Their cartoon version of you becomes writ so large that people start to believe it. At times, you begin to believe it yourself. People think you're a cartoon. They write about you as if you're a cartoon, and they treat you like you're a cartoon. And so, yes, you start to think of yourself as a cartoon and behave like one too, and the vicious cycle perpetuates itself. Everything changed when I lost George. That's when I thought, oh my God, I'm a person, a real person, not a cartoon one blundering through a life where nothing matters too much. Thanks, Dad. In fact, I've got these emotions and feelings and I don't know where to put them or what to do with them and I can't pretend any longer that they don't exist or don't matter. That was when I started learning how to become a more functioning human being. That's taken an apprenticeship too. It turns out I'm not a pop star per se. That was part of a ripple effect of what I do, and perhaps it will be again. It was a stage along the way, an odd Alice in Wonderland, exciting, tricky, confusing chapter. It turns out I'm a songwriter. It turns out my job is to write about what I see and what I've learned and what I feel and what I know. I then sing out those words using the best voice I can. It's not world class, but it's honest and true. I want, even if it's just for my daughters, for it to be strong and loud and clear. Now, I nearly called my latest album The Fourth Wall. The title made sense to me because I rarely lose myself on stage or in my performances. I'm always aware of the audience and never behind the fourth wall. Plus, the record is my fourth album, and I like wordplay, so the title worked on lots of levels. It was both an invitation, come into my world, and an explanation about my new work. Yes, I'm a performer, and these are my songs, but none of it is really a performance. It's just me. My words are true. This is how I feel, and this is what I've been through. This is how I see things. Then I thought, if the whole point of this record is my honesty, why am I going for wordplay? Why not get straight to the point? Who cares about conceptual levels of meaning? I thought. I need to simply say what I mean and feel. And that's why I called the album No Shame. When Seb, who knows me better than anyone else, and I started working together on this record, he said to me, "What do you want, Lily? Do you want fame and money, or do you want to make a record that is real and honest?" "The latter," I replied. "Good," said Seb. "As long as we stick to that, let's do it." And that's what we've done. We've made the record we want to make without compromising the songs. I still don't get to call all the shots because I don't write all the checks. I will have to listen to what the record label wants too, and no doubt I'll have to make compromises when it comes to marketing my work. But I haven't been scared to say no this time round. And if I feel like I have to drink a couple of glasses of champagne to get dressed or pose or behave in a certain way, then I'll know this isn't right, this isn't me, this isn't working. And I'll say no. I'm not doing sexy face again. I'm a performer, yes, but I'm also a mother and a daughter and a sister and a partner and an ex-wife and a friend and a writer and a collaborator, and I've finally learned that not one of these roles needs to be repressed in service to the others. Of course we all compartmentalize ourselves to a degree. We have to. None of us can be everything to everyone all the time. When I'm at work, the mother in me must accept that she needs to wait her turn. When I'm writing, I have to banish the friend who would welcome distraction. When I'm with my children, my other roles must wait in line, but none of them needs to be dismissed. I'm still a mother when I perform and write, still a writer and a singer when I'm with my children. I realize now that I don't have to pretend or fake things or divide myself into multiple parts. I can, instead, remain whole. We should all be able to live and work on our own terms, with integrity and without shame. I haven't always done it, but people do. And that's what I'm after. That's what I'm striving for. I've begun by reclaiming my voice. I felt stunned into silence when that first tabloid headline appeared on the front cover of the News of the World, just as Smile went to number one. From that moment on, I still spoke out, but I felt fearful. Whatever I said could be twisted or turned or blown up big or taken out of context. It was like I had this invisible, nebulous, all-knowing, all-watching, censorious gas that wafted around me all the time. That's one reason why drink and drugs felt safe. They allowed me to blot out the fear, at least to an extent. "You can't express opinions," the fear said. "Get back in your fucking box," it said. "We'll decide who you are, and we'll tell the world about it, and one day we might decide that you're unworthy and disgusting, and the next we might decide that you're great. You don't get to decide that. We do." Not anymore, motherfuckers. I don't feel fear anymore. The worst already happened, and it had nothing to do with anything I said or did. I lost my child, and it was just one of those things. I want my voice back. I'm getting my voice back. Here I am. Listen, I've got my voice back. We hope you have enjoyed listening to My Thoughts Exactly, written and read by Lily Allen. My Thoughts Exactly is published by Blink Publishing, an imprint of Bonnier Books, UK. Copyright 2018 by Lily Allen. Production copyright 2018 by Blink Publishing.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.